from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Another UN school in Gaza was shelled Wednesday, leaving a confirmed death toll of at least 19, with a total in Gaza of over 1,200 dead over the past 3 weeks. We have this report from Press TV.
The Palestinian Interior Ministry has blamed Israel for targeting the UN-run schools in Gaza, saying the world body must hold Israel responsible for the school attack. Middle East expert Saab Shath is now joining us from Belfast for more on that. Mr. Shath, welcome to the program. The issue of UN-run institutions being targeted by the Israelis, let's talk more about that. This is not the first time that it's happened in Israeli assaults on the Gaza Strip. In previous years and in previous wars, the same situation has occurred, and yet the Israelis have never been held accountable for their actions.
The irony of such actions, which in every war of aggression on Gaza, Israel always target United Nations schools and trying to find any pretext to do so. I think it sends a message to the international community saying they are above the international law and disregard the United Nations and its own resolutions regarding the 65 which asking Israel to commit itself to some sort of settlements in Palestine or consider the Palestinian rights. So this is one of its actions of arrogance. And for almost a year now, since the Palestinian, they become members of the United Nations or partly members of a graded status at the UN, the Palestinian leadership in Ramallah had a chance to open the door to justice for series of international and war crimes which committed on the Palestinian authorities' jurisdiction, like in the West Bank, of the burning of the Palestinian boy, the settlements, the attacks in homes, the settlers' attacks, or the war crimes committed continuously in the Gaza. They could seize the chance to deter future attacks by the Zionist entity of keeping attacking Gaza and the population of the Palestinians in the West Bank, and to take them to the ICC, the criminal International Criminal Court. But I don't know what is this presidency of Mahmoud Abbas is doing to allow or to sign a small letter to the ICC to ask them to join the Rome Convention, to be part of the at least the International Court, and ask the International Court to have jurisdiction in the territories under the Palestinian Authority's administration in the Gaza Strip. So there is a large question mark which is asking why a Palestinian authority in Ramallah is not seeking to protect its own people.
The United Nations, when it comes to addressing these issues, it also treads very lightly. In the United Nations Security Council statement issued a few days ago, once again, the United Nations just fell short of condemning that previous Israeli attack on a UN-run school. Why is that?
There is nothing really new about this if we look at what is supposed to be called, quote-unquote, the international community or the United Nations, which resulted from the Second World War, New Order, World Order. They are all United States of America's and allies' tools, and it's there to enforce the will of the United States against the other countries. The United Nations Security Council is supposed to be there to protect the people, to ensure world security, while we are witnessing civilians in Gaza under siege And I don't want to call them in a prison, because it's not a prison. As a friend of mine calls it, it's a concentration camp, and being bombarded while the international community, so supposed to be international community, watching that. This is tells us it's there is a hand in the United Nations and the United States of America is there, since Ban Ki-moon was in the West Bank in Israel. He could have 10 minutes been in Gaza and seen the devastation, and visiting even his own headquarters in Gaza and his schools seen targeted by Israel. So there is, I think, the United Nations in here have a lot to answer as well to the public opinion. And the public opinions realized the United States of America, whatever it's saying and is doing, they are partners with the Israelis and covering up the attacks on the Palestinians.
According to the New York Times on Wednesday, the casualties at the UN school, which was housing 3,300 Palestinian refugees, were caused by what appeared to be four Israeli artillery shells which hit the compound. Nevertheless, Marie Harf, the U.S. State Department's deputy spokesperson, was, to put it mildly, reluctant to place the blame on Israel, while also laying the groundwork to blame Hamas, even if it is proven with absolute certainty that the attack was launched by Israel.
The White House has just come out and condemned the shelling of the UNRWA school. Mm-hmm. Would you, can I just get you to offer the State Department's or the administration's full reaction to this?
Well, we do condemn the shelling of an UNRWA school in Gaza, which reportedly killed and injured innocent Palestinians, including children and UN humanitarian workers. Of course, we would also condemn those responsible for hiding weapons in United Nations facilities in Gaza as well. All of these actions and similar ones earlier in the conflict are inconsistent with the UN's neutrality, which we've spoken about in the past.
When you say that you condemn the shelling, mm-hmm. Whose shelling are we talking about here?
Well, we understand that UNRWA has put out a statement on its views. We would underscore the importance of a full and prompt investigation to determine the facts here.
So you are not ready to condemn Israel, per se, for the shelling of the school?
Correct. We haven't said that there needs to be a full investigation to see what happened here.
But you're condemning whoever it was that did it?
Correct.
This is the first time that you all have used this word. And granted, I think to most lay people, they don't really understand the gradations of, you know, when you say you're concerned, seriously concerned, you regret, you're dismayed by, there is a staging, there are different levels with which the United States and other governments convey their approval or disapproval of certain things. What condemn being up there pretty high is mm-hmm. the strongest, I suppose you could say, condemned in the strongest mm-hmm. possible terms. But why now? Why are you? Why didn't you condemn earlier shelling of UN facilities?
Well, we've throughout this process, Matt, condemned any attack on the UN's neutrality. So we've certainly said that. Again, we need to get all the facts here before we make determinations about what we'll say. And I'm happy to stand here today and to condemn, and I'm happy to condemn anytime the UN comes under fire like this throughout any conflict.
People in Israel, elsewhere actually, say that have made the case that there are rockets, as you noted, mm-hmm. and you also condemned the hiding of rockets in these schools. Do you believe that this was an attempt to go after Hamas militants that were hiding rockets, or go after a cache of rockets, or go after a legitimate target?
We're still trying to get all the facts here.
I understand that, but if you condemned the shelling, then
right,
I'm assuming
no matter what the purpose.
Okay, so even if there were militants, if there were people in there shooting out at the IDF, you would still condemn it?
Well, I'm going to condemn it here. As I said, and I would make another point on hiding of rockets, that when militants or terrorists hide rockets in schools, it exposes UN staff, it exposes Palestinian internally displaced people, and it exposes other civilians to danger and to attack. So obviously, we have seen a pattern of Hamas hiding rockets in schools. I don't know the facts. We don't know the facts in terms of this specific school, and we're trying to get that information right now.
According to UNRWA, this is the sixth time that one of their schools has been been hit. Israel has in the past said that it regrets any civilian casualties, says that it's doing its best not to to mitigate collateral damage. You have said in the past that you think Israel needs to do more to live up to its own very high standards. This keeps happening, though, and I'm wondering, these mistakes or these, I don't know if mistakes is the right word, but this seems to happen over and over again. Are you concerned that Israel is not attempting to live up to its own very high standards, or do you believe that they are trying to, but are falling short in these cases?
Well, I do believe that they are trying to live up to the high standards they set for themselves. And again, they are in a situation where Hamas is hiding rockets in places to prevent the Israelis from going after them. So look, Hamas is taking steps here that put civilians at risk. But we do believe the Israelis need to do more.
All right. And does your condemnation today of this incident imply or come with any kind of consequences?
In terms of what, Matt?
In terms of anything other than you saying you condemn it.
I think, look, the secretary, what he's been focused on, to take a little bit of a step back here, is talking to the parties, even though he was on his way to India and is now there, about how we can get a temporary ceasefire in place. He's continuing his efforts to this end. He's had extensive consultations with the Israelis, the Egyptians, the Palestinian Authority, and others. So, again, he is very focused on seeing if we can get a temporary ceasefire in place here so we can stop what's happening on the ground, and so we can get some humanitarian items into Gaza as well.
But that's not a consequence. He's been trying to do that from since before. Is there any? Are you aware of any discussion of any specific consequence that would result from your condemnation today of this one incident?
We're going to continue talking to the Israelis and the Palestinian Authority and the different parties about these issues.
Can I follow up on that? So you've condemned the shelling of the school, a UN facility, and you said that, you know, this is against the principles of UN neutrality. Mm-hmm. Can you hear, you know, just issue, are you issuing a call for both parties to avoid using the UN to making the UN a target?
I think that certainly would go without saying, but I'm happy to say it, Elise, that we have very strongly condemned the fact that Hamas has used UN facilities to hide rockets in, and we think that that is, of course, putting civilians at risk, and they should not do that. We also think that everyone, all sides, should take care to respect the UN's neutrality. As I said, all of this is inconsistent with that principle, which we think is very important. We know that Palestinian IDPs often seek out UN facilities because they have nowhere else to go, and so obviously we think it's important that all sides avoid UN facilities.
Well, you specifically mention Hamas hiding rockets there, but you say all sides. Specifically, are you asking the Israelis to not make any UN facilities a target because there are civilians that are seeking shelter there?
I'm not going to make a blanket statement, Elise.
Sometimes it's okay?
I'm not saying that. I'm just not going to make a blanket statement about what our private conversations with the Israelis look like.
Well, but, I mean, you can't publicly say that you don't think that Israel should make any UN facility a target regardless
of... that UN facilities should be targets, period.
A senior UN humanitarian official condemned the second attack in a week on a UN school in Gaza.
Appalled by the attacks on UN offices and schools in Gaza, the UN humanitarian chief has called on the fighters to show some humanity and morality. Ms. Valerie Amos, who's also the head of the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA, expressed alarm that more children and civilians were being killed and injured. Another UN school serving as a shelter has been hit in gross violation of international law, she deplored. On Tuesday, the OCHA office in Gaza, as well as the office of the UN Special Coordinator for the Middle East Peace Process, was hit five times. Gaza's sole power plant was also hit and is unlikely to be operable in the near future. And with over 10% of the population in Gaza displaced and in need of aid, Ms. Amos warned that her office's capacity is stretched to the limit. Meanwhile, the UN Middle East envoy has warned the parties to the conflict of their responsibility to protect UN property and assets, which must remain inviolable. Mr. Robert Suri said a more formal investigation is pending to determine the party responsible for the shelling of the UN compound. Jocelyn Sambira, United Nations.
And another senior UN humanitarian official characterized the humanitarian situation in Gaza as being in rapid and terrifying deterioration in a conversation with journalist Patrick Maigwa. This is Jens Larki, spokesperson for the UN's Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs.
This morning, we saw a very rapid and very terrifying deterioration of the situation. United Nations school sheltering civilians, children who had been displaced by the fighting. It was sheltering in the school, and that school came under fire and was bombed. We know that people have been killed, children have been killed. This is absolutely in flagrant violation of international law. These are the things that must stop. We have said before, there is no safe place for people in Gaza. Now, this is testament to that statement. These kind of violations of international law and indeed tragic loss of civilian lives must stop. So we are extremely alarmed.
How is the UN and the UN agency assisting the Palestinians? Are they able to deliver aid to those who are in need? Because if they are displaced, that means they are in need of aid. But then there is the bombings that are going on around them. Are you able to deliver aid to those who are in need?
We are able to deliver some aid. We estimate there is about 250,000 people displaced now in Gaza. About 200,000 of them are in UN facilities. We are delivering food. We are delivering water. We are trying our best to provide health care to the people who are in desperate need of such assistance. Now, it is a war zone. Humanitarian workers are unprotected. They are civilians themselves. So it is an extremely dangerous, extremely difficult and complicated environment to deliver aid in. But we are delivering to the best of our ability.
But the message that humanitarian agencies on the ground need a humanitarian pause has not been heeded by any of the sides to the conflict.
Unfortunately, correct. The killing, the bombings, the destruction continues. Despite that, we did have a short-lived ceasefire at the political level. They have not been able to negotiate an extension of that as we speak. Now, what we need to do now is call on everybody with influence over the parties on the ground to put people first.
An interesting day in the House of Representatives Tuesday.
After the Soviet Union fell, there was a tremendous potential to making Russia our friend. A tremendous potential. They withdrew their troops from Eastern Europe. The Russians were open to all kinds of interacting and becoming part of the world community, and a tremendous opportunity, was squandered.
That was Representative Donna Rohrabacher, a Republican from California who chairs the House Foreign Affairs Subcommittee on Europe, Eurasia, and Emerging Threats, at a hearing Tuesday entitled "The Shootdown of Malaysian Flight 17 and the Escalating Crisis in Ukraine." He questioned Dr. Leon Aron, resident scholar and director of Russian studies at the right-wing think tank American Enterprise Institute, Anthony Salvia, executive director of the American Institute in Ukraine, and Ian Brzezinski, a former principal at the consulting firm Booz Allen Hamilton, who was the son of President Jimmy Carter's national security advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski.
First of all, do we agree that this was not an intentional shoot down of this airline? Does everyone agree that? I mean, nobody said, let's shoot down a commercial airline. With that said, there are, not counting the victims of this airline, did we say there was 800 people who've been killed since February?
According to the New York Times of yesterday, they gave a figure of 800 since April.
Okay, is that a figure about right with the rest of you?
Probably more like 1,000.
Probably more.
Yeah, I've seen
now, of
figures.
Those who were dead, how many are civilians from the eastern part of Ukraine who have been killed by the military operations by the Ukrainian government in that region of the dead, of the 800 dead? We're talking about half of them, or the vast majority of them,
Mr. Chairman, it's very difficult, you know, in the conditions of the urban warfare, it's very difficult to establish which side killed how many people. And the propaganda efforts on both sides are tremendous.
So would you agree with that, Mr. Silva?
I think so, yeah.
That it's hard to tell?
Absolutely, yes.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me that it wouldn't be that hard to tell. It seems to me that if you have dead civilians on the ground in eastern Ukraine, that you would have to assume that they were not being shot intentionally by the separatists who are there as part of their community. That would seem to be that way.
Mr. Chairman, it's hard to tell. We don't know. Right. But what we do know is that we have recently seen that there have been, that the separatists have killed civilians and put them in a grave, in a mass grave. We found this over the last couple of days. So
the separatists killed the civilians.
Yes, sir.
For what reason did they do that?
We don't know, sir. What we know is there are some dead people.
Has there been any ceasefires in this between the separatists and the Ukrainian army? There have been?
How many ceasefires
have there been?
There were several, but the latest one, if you remember, Mr. Chairman, the latest one is, of course, because of MH17. Mm-hmm. It was a unilateral ceasefire. But the one before ended when the separatists attacked the Donetsk airport. It was a unilateral ceasefire by Ukraine, and it was broken by the separatists.
Okay, so there have been ceasefires that, do we know, do you agree with that, Dr. Silvia? There were ceasefires. How many ceasefires do we know of there?
Well, the main one was one Dr. Aaron was referring to, which was June 20th to June 30th. It was a 10-day ceasefire that then, you know, ended in renewed fighting.
Okay. Have there been other ceasefires?
Brief ones. Again, as Dr. Aaron was to do with the immediate shootdown of the airplane, there was a brief, you know.
Okay.
So there's not been a prolonged ceasefire coupled with serious negotiations.
I think your point that we have been calling for ceasefires in Palestine-Israeli ceasefires, but we don't seem to be putting that type of energy into calling for ceasefires and negotiations in Ukraine. Is this issue one of where people are demanding federalism and there's not a negotiation on this issue? Or is this just a matter of the people are just demanding that they have a separate status, totally separate status, and become independent of Ukraine? The people who are actually fighting, what demand have they made?
Sir, I guess my impression is that while there's generally always a demand for more autonomy from regions,
yes,
this conflict wasn't created by Ukrainians seeking greater autonomy. It was created by Russian operatives who were sent into eastern Ukraine and seized buildings and violently closed off the region.
So the That's people who were seizing it. Buildings, the first buildings that were seized that I remember in Ukraine were seized by the people who were trying to force the democratically elected president out of his office, seizing buildings in the eastern part, in the western part of Ukraine. And those, I'm sure those were local people, although there's been the suggestions that they were very radical. And so buildings were seized there. I will have to say that, do you agree, Doctor, with that analysis that the people who were basically starting this and seizing those buildings originally were all Russian agents and not local people?
Well, I don't know. I think I may go a bit far. You know, I mean, it certainly is true what you say, that a lot of this, you know, originated last winter when you had the efforts to overthrow what you correctly say was the democratically elected government of Ukraine. A government which faced elections in February of 2015, which would have given the opposition, in other words, if the opposition in Ukraine was upset with what Yanukovych did about the European Association Agreement, they had a whole year to organize, to deal with the matter at the ballot box. After all, the Maidan movement, which I was hugely sympathetic to myself personally, was all about European values. Well, what are European Western values but free elections?
Meanwhile, the group of independent experts from Australia and the Netherlands investigating the crash of Malaysian Airlines Flight 17 was again unable to reach the crash site due to heavy attacks from the Ukrainian army. This according to the Australian Federal Police. The police agency said Wednesday in a media release, quote, "The joint team of Australian and Dutch investigators, accompanied by independent monitors from the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, have again suspended any attempt today to visit the MH17 wreckage whilst negotiations continue to secure safe access to the site," close quote. A truce had been agreed to in the 40-kilometer zone around the site between both the pro-Kiev military and local defense forces, but the Ukrainian army later continued its offensive against the militia in its attempt to recapture the city of Donetsk. So far, the team of international investigators has been able to access the site only sporadically. Rival militias fighting for control of Tripoli Airport agreed Wednesday to a temporary ceasefire. The move was prompted by the need to allow firefighters to try to control a huge blaze at a fuel depot hit by a rocket. Some of the worst fighting since the 2011 NATO war on Libya has been taking place in recent days. Most Western governments have followed the U.S. and the U.N. in pulling their diplomats out of the North African country. Meanwhile, more than 20 people were killed and dozens missing when a vessel carrying migrants from Libya capsized off the coast Wednesday. According to a Libyan Navy spokesperson, the incident occurred about 100 kilometers east of Tripoli. The ship was reportedly carrying 150 people from Central and Southern Africa to Italy. As of Wednesday, the search for survivors continued. The U.S. State Department announced Wednesday it was imposing travel restrictions on a number of Venezuelan government officials who it said were involved in human rights abuses. The State Department declined to name such parties because of visa record confidentiality, but cited, quote, "arbitrary detentions, excessive force, and judicial intimidation," closed quote, against Venezuelan protesters. As Japan, with the encouragement of Washington, has moved to abrogate its constitutional prohibition against war and embarked on an aggressive rearmament program, some in the country still remember what happened before. One woman who witnessed the death and destruction of World War II, now in her 90s, is speaking out. We have this report from the Japanese news agency, NHK World.
Almost 70 years after World War II, a veteran storyteller in Japan's southernmost prefecture is still sharing her experiences of that dark time. More than 200,000 people, including many civilians, were killed in the Battle of Okinawa. She's making sure future generations never forget. NHK World's Mariko Nakamura has the story.
There's nothing I hate more than war. I'm still here after losing 11 members of my family.
Toshie Asato is 93 now, but she recounts her wartime experiences as if they happened yesterday. In 1945, fighting engulfed her home. Many of her relatives died in front of her eyes. Clutching her young baby, she fled to the hills. She finally found a cave to hide in, but there was very little food. Her baby daughter, Kazuko, died in her arms.
It was pitch black in the cave. After Kazuko died, I hugged her close and told all kinds of things to her. I'm so sorry. Soon I'll follow you, and we'll be together again. So please, wait for me.
It makes me think we must work to create a country that doesn't go to war.
Later, Asato became a kindergarten teacher. She wanted to make sure that the children born after the war would grow up healthy. After she retired, she decided to become a full-time storyteller, mostly speaking to children. She treasured the message they sent her as a sign that her stories are getting through.
Here they've written, "War is horrible." The children wrote this card right after listening to me speak. They say, "We must all work hard to create a country at peace."
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.